Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, a conversation with author Ann Patchett. This past January, as part of my special author interview series, I spoke with my friend and one of my favorite authors, Ann Patchett. Ann has been prolific of late, writing essays in the New Yorker and Harper's that explore her past, the pandemic, aging, and death. We discussed all those topics, as well as her 2019 novel, The Dutch House, and her independent bookstore in Nashville, Parnassus. Ann's novels include State of Wonder and Commonwealth. Her 2001 book, Bel Canto, won the Pen Faulkner Award. This conversation was recorded over Zoom on January 27th. I hope you enjoy. Ann Patchett, how great to see you again.
Hi, Diane. Yeah, this modern world. Look at us seeing each other.
Look at us, and look at that gorgeous painting behind you.
Yeah.
The cover of The Dutch House. Tell us how that cover came to be and why you chose it.
It's such a great story. And I would like to say, you know, like everybody else, I have been doing Zooms for 10 months. And I just yesterday figured out that I could haul in the 8-foot ladder from the garage, set my computer on it, bring a bar stool over, and actually include the painting in the conversation. So this is brand new country. This is what happens when you Zoom for 10 months. So when I finished The Dutch House, I knew that I didn't want a house on the cover. I knew that The Dutch House had to exist in the imagination of the reader. So I didn't want a door or a window or something. And I knew that that's where it would go. I have, over the course of my career, become extremely proactive about covers. And I really understand that the only way to get what you want is to tell somebody what you want upfront before they have any ideas of their own. So in the book, there is a painting of Maeve in the Dutch House. And I wanted that painting to be on the cover of the book. And I looked archivally through a lot of museum websites to try to find a sort of John Singer Sargent style painting of a girl with black hair and a red coat. Any painting that I found that was sufficiently classical, the girl would have on a bonnet or a pinafore. It was the wrong era. So I called my editor, who was in favor of this idea. I said, I have a friend in Nashville, Noah Satterstrom, and I bet he could just paint it. And because my editor and the art director are in New York, they said, oh, that's a really great idea. But listen, what we're going to do is make a list of 10 painters. We're going to have them submit sample sketches. Then we're going to have a meeting, and then we're going to choose. And I got off the phone and I thought, well, you know, I can commission whatever I want. And if it works, it works. So I called Noah and I said, I need a painting of a 10-year-old girl with blue eyes, black hair, and a red coat, painted in 1950 in the style of 1910 by a Scotsman. And he said, I'm on it. And he did the painting in 4 days.
Really?
Yeah. I picked out the wallpaper in the background. He said, come look at wallpaper. We picked out the wallpaper. I changed the description in the book to fit the wallpaper. And then I took a picture of it, sent it to my editor. I said, here's the cover. He said, why, yes, that is.
Of course that is. Did it never occur to you to want to have the Dutch House itself on the cover?
No, because the Dutch House has to exist in the reader's imagination. There are actually surprisingly few details of the Dutch House. The details that there are, the window seat and the front hallway and the clock and the stairs, I hit those details over and over again. But there are not sort of broad general details, because what I want is, this is the best house Diane Reams ever been in. You know, this is the house that you went into once and thought, what would it be like to live in this house? This is the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. So using the reader's imagination in that way was important. And as soon as you have some visual image, it closes down that imagination.
You know, a number of people have likened the story to a fairy tale with a wicked stepmother. Is that what you intended your readers to think of?
So when I published my first novel, The Patron Saint of Liars, in 1992, Alice McDermott, God love her, wrote a lovely review of it for the New York Times. And the line was, a fairy tale, a delight. I do believe that that sentence has been pulled out and used on every single thing I've written since. So, you know, on one hand, yes, there are definitely fairy tale aspects of this book. I mentioned Hansel and Gretel. As far as the wicked stepmother is concerned, man, I have known some wicked stepmothers. I don't think that that is entirely the stuff of fairy tales. I actually do think, especially if you have children of your own, it can be very hard for many women who marry into a family and want to have their own family to deal in a loving and responsible way with the family that they inherit. Not across the board, but it is. Andrea is not a far-fetched character. She is not a fairy tale character. She is definitely within the realm of stories that I have heard about in my own life. So I think that the other reason that I get the fairy tale thing a lot is because I like a plot. I'm very old-fashioned in that way. I like a beginning, middle, and end. I like a story that builds. I like a bit of a moral. And those are fairy tale aspects. But there are also aspects of fables and of lives of the saints and all those little stories I grew up on.
I want to ask you about that because there is a very strong religious element. Many have commented on the sense of Catholicism that somehow runs through this. And I don't know if you were raised as a Roman Catholic.
Yeah.
Catholic school.
12 years. Catholic girls' school for 12 years. And what happened was my parents got divorced when I was 4. And I was born in Los Angeles. My mother moved my sister and me across country to Nashville. And my father was the Catholic. He came from a big Catholic family. They grew up next door to a church. They went to church 7 days a week. They were all altar boys. My grandfather was an altar boy until he died in his 90s. And so my father, it was very important for him that my mother send us to Catholic school because he knew that she would not be taking us to church. So yeah, at 12 years of Catholic school. And now I think you know this, that I have my own nun, Sister Nina, who taught me how to read in first through third grade, is now 88. And I keep her up. She is my nun.
And you still have lunch with her fairly frequently.
And now I have two. I have Sister Judy as well. Because you get one and then the next thing you know, you have two. They are my connection. I only really go to church when I go to church with Sister Nina, and nobody goes to church now anyway. But I still very much identify as a Catholic. And I always think Catholicism, being a Catholic, is like being an American. There is a lot about the way this country works that does not please me. But it is my country, and I am not leaving it. And that is the way I feel about my religion as well. It is my religion, and I get a lot out of it, and I still associate with it without, you know, buying into a large majority of what it stands for. I can't deny that that's what I am.
Do you identify thereby with Elna, the mother of in the Dutch house, who leaves her children to apparently at first go off to India to help the poor? She cannot bear the fanciness of this Dutch house. She's got to get away from it. And so she leaves. She leaves those children behind.
Yeah, that would be my psychological problem, right? Right there in a nutshell. I wrote this book twice. And when I wrote it the first time, it was a book about Elna. It definitely started out as a book about Elna and about, you know, when they get their money at the end of World War II, and she has no idea that Cyril has made this money, they go from being poor to being rich. And at that time in this country, there really was not an American middle class, or there was a very small one. You were either poor and your friends were all poor, and that's how you identified, that's how you lived, or you were a Rockefeller, and there just wasn't a lot in the middle. And to go from one to the other with no warning was such a whiplash for her. It was just more than she could stand. Her identity, her heart, everything she believed in was with the poor, the nobility of the poor. And I have to say, that is Kool-Aid that I drank the whole time I was growing up, that nobility, deepest nobility, really was giving up what you had and being one with the poor. That's the basis of probably all world religions. And I've certainly not gotten there. It's very funny when my husband and I go for walks, you know, and he'll say, oh, I saw this house for sale. It's so beautiful. And what he'll show me is something that looks like a castle. And I will pass a 1,200 square foot bungalow and say, God, can you imagine how great it would be to live there? And what we do is we live someplace that's very much in the middle of those two things.
So the fact of the matter is, when you wrote Bel Canto, you went from someone who had perhaps enough money to someone who became rich.
Yeah.
How did that change your life and your thinking about your Catholicism?
It's something that I struggle with. And I'll tell you the thing about Bel Canto, I bought a house. I went from living in a kind of a crummy efficiency apartment to I went and bought a house without a mortgage. And that was before I was married. You know, I do the best I can. I give a lot of money away. I don't give everything away. And it's something that I struggle with a lot. At this point in my life, I cannot think of anything I want. There's not a necklace or a sweater or a car in the world that I want. I'm set. I've got everything. And so all of my joy is, you know, giving things away. And that doesn't mean that I'm a better person. It just means that that's my joy.
Is or was opening Parnassus part of that thinking?
It was, actually. You know, the bookstores in Nashville had closed. We had to have a bookstore. I thought, okay, this is like your symphony is going out of business. You have to live in a city with a symphony. I will support my city by opening a bookstore. But the biggest joke is I always say I was born under the 13th astrological sign, which is the dollar sign. And even when I was a kid, you know, it's like if I enter a contest, I win. Everything I do winds up making money. I have always been that way. So the bookstore, which was supposed to be this generous gesture to my city in which I would lose my shirt. In fact, even through the pandemic, we've done okay.
But you have to talk about the importance of these independent bookstores throughout the country, many of which have been struggling.
Absolutely. We've struggled, but it's more like we've pivoted. And my message for the last 9 years that we've been open has been, you know, yes, you can get your books for less money on Amazon, But if you shop local and you support your bookstore, then you have story time and author events and a community center and smart booksellers who recommend books and a place to feel like you belong. And you're putting money into your community, into your tax base, into schools and police departments. And, you know, I had the whole thing. And then we closed. And suddenly people, certainly from Nashville, but from all over the country, were ordering their books from Parnassus. Huh. And they were full price books. And they were not getting any benefit. They were doing it because they were decent and kind people who were helping us stay in business. And I think for so many independent bookstores across the country, that's been true, that people have really stepped up to the plate and helped little businesses stay open. And my whole thing is, you know, the pandemic is going to be over at some point. And if you don't take care of the little businesses that you love during the pandemic, they're just not going to be there when it's over. And then you can walk down to your bookstore and find that it's all shuttered. But it's been astonishing and deeply moving to me that people have realized that. And we've been a shipping center. We are letting people in now. And I do this whole thing where I make Instagram videos every week in which I hold up books and cuddle with them, and I wear a ball gown or a cocktail dress and all my jewelry, which is funny. And I say, the new George Saunders. Oh my God, you have to read the new George Saunders. It's going to change your life. It's going to make you a better person. And that's what I do. And that's really worked.
You mentioned that your mother and father were divorced when you were four. In fact, you've had three fathers about whom you've written, and you wrote an article about having those three fathers come together, however reluctantly or happily. Tell us about that story and how you managed to bring them together and what the experience was like.
Well, so my mother married three times, and when my sister got married, my sister and I both got married in 2005. We got married a couple of months apart. And my husband and I just eloped, signed some papers. But my sister had a really lovely wedding. And I realized that all three of my mother's husbands were going to be there. And I wanted to get a picture of myself with the three fathers because they were all very important. I was very, very close to all three of them and stayed close to all three of them my whole life. So well before Heather's wedding, I called all three of them and said, would you have this picture made with me? And they all agreed. They were very nice about it. And at the wedding, when we were taking pictures and setting it all up, and I was away. There was one picture of just the three of them, and then one picture of the three of them with me. And with just the three of them, my stepfather, Mike, who was the middle father and really the father that I spent the most of my life with, said to my father and my then stepfather, you know what she's doing, don't you? She's going to get this picture of us. And then when we're all dead, she's going to write an article for the New Yorker, and this is going to be the illustration. And they both said, oh, you're right, you're right. And sure enough, you know, they were right. And that was always what I had planned to do. And then they all died. And I just kind of didn't have the heart for it anymore. I was sad and kind of felt like, oh, I cannot even imagine how I would start the work of writing this story. And then my friend Kate DiCamillo's father died, and she and I were talking a lot, and she said, I'm going to write a story about my father. I'm going to write an essay about my father. And I said, oh, okay, good. I'm going to go with you, okay? If you're going to write an essay about your father, then I'll write this essay that I've been putting off writing for 5 years. By that time, they had all been dead for quite a while. And so Kate and I wrote our father essays together, and I was so grateful. I was so grateful. It was like having a buddy to go with while I was doing this hard thing that wound up being very rewarding.
How hard was it for you to write that piece?
It was hard because I wanted to be honest.
Yeah.
And I really, really loved all three of them so much. And they were like the three, back to the whole fairy tale thing, you know, they were like the three fairies who come and visit Sleeping Beauty, the three graces that come and visit Sleeping Beauty. You know, they each brought me a present, the three wise men, they each brought me a present that shaped my character. But then, you know, they were also all three difficult and weird. So I had to kind of walk the line and be true and be loving at the same time.
And they were all good to you?
Yeah, they really were. They were absolutely all very good to me and taught me different things. And I think in that way, I have always been lucky. I also have a fabulous stepmother. My father married my stepmother when I was 8 or 9. And my father is dead. My stepmother is A-okay. And she's one of my favorite people in the world. So I had a super abundance of parents. And the nice thing about that is I was never disappointed in any of them. You know, I had the parent who would always come through for me emotionally, and the parent who always came through for me financially, and the parent who believed in my work, and the parent who would listen to my stories, and the parent who thought I was funny, and the parent who wanted to go on trips with me. So I never looked at any of them with any kind of expectation. So many people are so disappointed by their parents, but I had way too many of them to be disappointed in any of them.
Didn't you ever say to your mother, "Mom, what's going on here? How come you keep leaving these men?"
Well, you know, let's see. My parents got divorced when I was 4. My mother married Mike when I was 6. They split up and got back together again several times. They had a rocky marriage. But when I was 24, they were done. So by that time, I'm 24, you know, and then I was 27 when she married again. You know, at that point, it doesn't make any difference. It's not my business. I remember when my mother was married for the third time, we were talking one day and she said to me in a very offhanded way, "Oh, you know, I look back on the whole thing now and I probably just should have stayed married to your father." Like, "Oh, wow. God, don't say that."
Wow.
That's horrifying, right? Like the idea that we did all of this for a reason, that's okay. The idea that we did it for no reason at all, that's not okay.
I get it.
People do the best they can do. And, you know, nobody was abusive. Nobody was addicted. Nobody was mean. Everybody was just trying to find their way.
I'm interested that your father, and I presume this is your true father, was a reader, but didn't want you to become a writer. How dumb.
Because if you're a kid, and I was not an academic star, to put it mildly, but it is exactly like saying, "I want to be a movie star." You know, is that what you want for your kid? Because you know the chances are just so fleetingly small that it's going to happen. I mean, I really do look back and understand that. He wouldn't have wanted that kind of a heartbreak for me. When I meet young people now and they say, "I want to be a writer. I want to write literary fiction. I want to write poetry." I think,
really?
Yeah, it is. It's like saying, I'm gonna go on Broadway and dance for a living. The chances are so small. There was a time when I was a kid and we did all sorts of unbelievably stupid things. And my sister and my stepbrothers and sisters and I were all swimming in a lake. And then we got to this sort of an island and we crawled up a cliff. It was incredibly stupid. without any supervision. And we were just kind of all six of us pulling ourselves up on roots, and we were wet and muddy and sliding and climbing. And we got to the top and looked down and thought, oh my God.
Yeah.
Oh my God, what did I just do? What an enormous mistake that was. And that's how I feel about writing. That's how it feels. I got to the top and I looked back and thought, what made you think you could do that? And the only thing that made me think that I could do that was naivete, you know, that I didn't know any better. So I just thought, well, that's what I want to do. That's what I'm going to do. But when you go through and you watch the attrition over time, you know, you watch your friends who never publish a book, who publish one book, who fall by the wayside after their third book, and don't make a living at it. It's really perilous. And when people say to me now, you know, I want to write, and I say, absolutely write, absolutely do it, but do it because you love it. Play the cello because you love the cello, not because you think you're going to be Yo-Yo Ma. It has to come from the love of the art and the craft, and not because you think that you are going to have financial reward.
More of my conversation with Ann Patchett when we come back.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here's the rest of my conversation with author Ann Patchett. This was recorded on January 27th as part of the Diane Rehm Book Club. And at this point, let's take a listen to Tom Hanks, and I'm going to talk about him reading from the book, The Dutch House.
I will always believe that Andrea's face fell for an instant when she looked at Maeve and me. Even if my father hadn't mentioned his children, she would have known he had them. Everyone in Elkins Park knew what went on in the Dutch house. Maybe she thought we would stay upstairs. She'd come to see the house, after all, not the children. Or maybe the look on Andrea's face was just for Maeve, who at 15 and in her tennis shoes was already a head taller than Andrea in her heels. Maeve had been inclined to slouch when it first became apparent she was going to be taller than all the other girls in her class and most of the boys. And her father was relentless in his correction of her posture. Head up, shoulders back might as well have been her name. For years, he thumped her between the shoulder blades with the flat of his palm whenever he passed her in a room, the unintended consequence of which was that Maeve now stood like a soldier in the queen's court, or like the queen herself. Even I could see how she might have been intimidating. Her height, the shining black wall of hair, the way she would lower her eyes to look at a person rather than bend her neck. But at 8, I was still comfortably smaller than the woman our father would later marry. I held out my hand to shake her little hand and said my name. Then Maeve did the same. Though the story will be remembered that Maeve and Andrea were at odds right from the start, that wasn't true. Maeve was perfectly fair and polite when they met, and she remained fair and polite until doing so was no longer possible. "How do you do?" Maeve said, and Andrea replied that she was very well. Andrea was well. Of course she was. It had been Andrea's goal for years to get inside the house, to loop her arm through her father's arm when going up the wide stone steps and across the red-tiled terrace. She was the first woman our father had brought home since our mother left, though Maeve told me that he had had something going with our nanny for a while, an Irish girl named Fiona.
Oh, what a reading. Take us back and tell us how you succeeded in getting Tom Hanks to read your book for you.
It's a crazy story. So Tom Hanks is a friend of mine. What a world, right? And the reason that I know him is because I blurbed his book, Uncommon Type, which is a collection of short stories, which really is terrific. I would say that an actor that talented has no business writing short stories that are that good, but he did, and they are. And I blurbed the book, and then I was asked to come to DC and interview him on stage for Politics and Prose. And I did, and we started talking, and he was interested in opening a bookstore and wanted my advice. And his wife, Rita Wilson, is a singer-songwriter, and they come to Nashville quite often, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, I started seeing them. And when I finished writing the book, on a complete lark, I sent him an email and said, hey, I just finished writing a book with a first-person narrator who's a man, you know, any chance you'd want to do the audio? And he wrote back in about 5 minutes and said, oh, that sounds like fun. Send me the book. I'll see if it will work. And I was so horrified because, you know, it's one thing to ask, but you just don't ever think the person's going to say yes.
Yeah.
And then when they say yes, I was like, oh my God, what have I done? Because it was such a huge ask. And what you're saying is, hi, Tom Hanks, can you give me 4 days of your life?
Exactly.
And all of your talent. And he did. And the book is so much better when you hear it. And people think I'm being self-effacing when I say that, but this is the way it works. So here's the Dutch House. And this is all of my talent and all of my ability. That's the best book I know how to write. And here comes Tom Hanks. And there's all of his talent and all of his ability right on top. And it becomes something just exponentially larger because you are more than doubling whatever is in that book. And one of the things that I loved so much, I listened to it. It was the first time I've ever listened to any of my audiobooks.
Really?
Well, yeah, I don't ever listen or read or anything. Once it's done, it's done. But so many people had told me it was great, and I listened to it, and it was so funny. I really was doubled over at a couple of points laughing. And that was so meaningful to me because I think of myself as a funny writer. And people are always telling me how heartbreakingly sad my books are. And
I think exactly.
They're funny. They're really funny. And the way Tom read Danny with this sort of bored entitlement, like he was just always sighing and rolling his eyes, it was hysterical. And this is a great story. So Tom and Rita were in Nashville. She was singing at the Grand Ole Opry. And there are two shows in the Grand Ole Opry. No one in Nashville would be caught dead at the Grand Ole Opry. I took my husband there. I said, when's the last time you went to the Opry? He was like, I never went to the Opry. Nobody goes to the Opry. So there are two people are bussed in from Ohio in order to go to the Opry. There are two seatings. There are two shows and it's the same show twice. So Rita sings at 7 o'clock and then she'll sing again at 9:30. So after she sang, we went backstage and sat in the dressing room with Tom and Rita, and get this, Dionne Warwick.
Oh my.
Who was also singing at the Opry that night. So we're all sitting back there and we're talking. And I said to Tom, it was the first time I'd seen him since I had listened to the audio. And I'm saying this whole thing about, you know, I'm so touched because it's funny. And you think of this as funny. And I think of myself as funny. And nobody thinks I'm funny. But you saw that in me. You saw that in the book. And I'm so touched. And Tom and Rita both got these like sad parent looks on their face. And they both said, oh, Anne, we think you're funny. Oh, no, you're funny. I was like, that's not what I mean. Anyway.
So from Tom Hanks, mm-hmm. you met his assistant.
Yes.
And that is such a beautiful story about which you also wrote. Tell us about Suki.
You know, I wrote this endlessly long piece. It's 20,000 words. It's huge. About my relationship with Suki Raphael, who is Tom Hanks's assistant, and our friendship. And by the craziest story ever, which I won't even get into, it wound up in Harper's Magazine. It never occurred to me that I would publish that thing in a magazine because it is so enormous. And Diane, of everything I have ever written in my life, I think that piece has gone around the globe 3 times.
Wow.
Anybody who ever drove me from the airport to an event in Cleveland has written and said, I read that piece. It meant so much to me.
It's been so touching. It's been so beautiful. Tell us the story.
The story, and I will say, if you go to Harper's Magazine, there's no paywall. So if you haven't read it, you can read it online at Harper's Magazine. Suki and I started emailing each other, actually, because she was the person who found the 4 days in Tom's schedule to put together so he could do the audiobook. And I think that most people have had this experience, but I have it a lot, where you sort of, you know, you get so fond of somebody on email, and you strike up this fond little correspondence with somebody who you don't really know. And that was me and Suki. And we would write to each other. And she was so interesting and lovely and smart. And then I found out she had had pancreatic cancer and that she was trying to get into a clinical trial because it had come back. She had recurrent pancreatic cancer. And my husband is a doctor here in Nashville. And I'm telling him the story. And he said, oh, have her send me her lab reports and her files. I'll talk to the oncologist at the hospital where I work. They are running more trials for recurrent pancreatic cancer than anybody else in the country right now. And it's all about a match, you know, finding the exact trial for your cancer that has an opening in it. And she got into the trial here and came and lived with us. She said, absolutely not. I'm not coming to live with you. That's crazy. We don't know each other. I said, you know, just try it for a week. And then the pandemic hit and she was stuck here. And we lived together for 3 months and we were so happy. And she was a brilliant painter and she had a great journey towards herself as an artist. And we have a very, very deep friendship.
This seems to me part of your own description of yourself as a Roman Catholic. Mm. Somehow being willing not only to open yourself to that friendship, but to then invite her to live with you and your husband for the 3 months while she was part of this trial. How did that work?
Well, she's not the first person who's come to live with us. And if it is Catholicism on my part, and I don't know that it is, because I don't think that Catholics, you know, worldwide just take people into their house. It has a lot to do also with my husband, who is from Mississippi and is just a very open, friendly person. I mean, I think that it is being open to the possibility of experience. I got a letter from a woman yesterday who works in a bookstore that I've been to several times. And she said, this just killed me. She said, I'm having a double mastectomy on Wednesday. And I wish I could come and live with you.
Wow.
And I wrote her back and I said, I wish you could too. Wow. And that's part of it. Like, people have different skills. And I'm very good at sick. And that has to do with growing up in a medical family. I'm very, very comfortable with sick. And I think that a lot of people just aren't. They're made so uncomfortable, the awkwardness, the not knowing what to say. I have a friend in Nashville and now who's dying, and I go over and see her once a week or so and read. And And they have so many friends and a big family and they're wonderful. And her husband always says to me, we want you to come because you're the only person who's not freaked out. And I'm not.
Here is a comment from a viewer, a listener, who says, thanks, Anne, for the lovely, evocative Harper's essay about your friend Zookie. I had to stop myself from racing to find out how it ends. So happy to find that it didn't.
Yeah. And it will. You know, it will. But right now, which is all any of us have got, right now, we're all still here.
Someone else goes on to, referring back to the Dutch house, to say, Maeve's death was such a shock to me. Did you write it to be a shock like that, like some deaths are in real life?
You know, the first time that I wrote this book, Maeve died in the middle of the book, and it was a disaster because the story ends when she dies. And the thing is, it is a shock, and yet everything in the book is saying she's going to die. I mean, everything in the book sets you up for it. I have to tell you, yesterday, a really, really close friend of mine died of a heart attack.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Someone who I loved, who was 69. She smoked 2 packs a day her entire life. She had some other bad habits. You just couldn't find anybody in worse health. And yet, it was exactly like Maeve, right? It was every sign pointed to it. How could I be shocked to get that call? But I was floored because we always are. We always are.
Death is so final. We never know when it will come for any of us or any of our friends. But to have someone die shockingly, even though we're all going to die, still really hits you in the gut.
Well, I got to say, Diane, you've written more beautifully about death than just about anyone. And even when I think back about your husband, I mean, even in that case, when you are so pointedly and knowingly making a journey towards death, it's still shocking.
It's still shocking.
That moment is, I don't care what the circumstances are, you still can't believe it. So.
Here's a comment from a fellow Nashvillian. Thank you, Anne, for representing our city in such a beautiful, intelligent, generous manner.
Oh, that's so kind.
Isn't that lovely?
I love our city, and I love our city now more than ever.
And of course, you were so busy before the pandemic, and now you've had to shut down. You're not doing any of the things you would normally be doing.
You know, what I wonder about is the future, because I have to tell you, I feel like I have spent my life without really understanding that I was doing it, building this Iron Man suit. And I am an introvert and I am quiet and shy. And piece by piece, I have made this incredible public performance self that I wear. And in the pandemic, I have taken it off. And I am myself. Like, I have not been myself since I was in my 20s. I am open-hearted. I am happy. I am tender. I live with a sense of immediacy, and I don't want to go back. I don't want to get on a plane. I don't want to sleep in a hotel room. I don't want to stand on a stage. I don't want to present an award to anyone. And also, I don't want to kill the planet. You know, I don't think that my getting on a plane and giving this talk with you, Diane, when I think about the times that I was giving a reading in New York and had to get in a car at 10 o'clock at night to be driven to Washington, D.C., so I could get up and be in the studio to be face-to-face with you, to be on a radio show at 9 o'clock in the morning, it's madness. This works. This thing that we're doing now, all the people who can join in, all the people who have never seen an author, who can, because they live in some tiny little town in the middle of nowhere, they can join into this experience, and we're not destroying the planet in the same way at the same speed.
So you truly believe your life is going to change?
I mean, the question is really, do I have the courage of my conviction? Mm-hmm. And will there still, will this portal that we've created where we can do this thing virtually, will that portal stay open, or will people? I was on the Seth Meyers show last night. Okay. It was great. I was sitting right here. I don't think that it would have been somehow a more meaningful experience if I had been sitting at his desk in New York.
And on that note, my dear friend Anne, we have to end our time together. What are you writing now?
Oh, I am finishing final edits on a book that's coming out the Tuesday before Thanksgiving. It is an essay collection called These Precious Days.
Ah.
The father essay is in there, the Sookie essay is in there, and I have just been writing essays for the last 10 months.
Perfect. I will look forward to that.
Hey, Diane.
Yes.
Love you.
Love you, Anne.
I really do. I'm so grateful to you for having me. I'm so grateful that you are providing a way for all of us to connect. I really value you and appreciate you. So thank you.
Thank you, Anne. It's been a delight.
Yeah, it has. Thank you.
That was novelist Anne Patchett. She's the author of the novels The Dutch House, State of Wonder, Commonwealth, and Bel Canto, which won the Penn Faulkner Award. That conversation was recorded on January 27th as part of the Diane Rehm Book Club. And that's all for today. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman, Sandra Baker, and Allison Brody. Our engineer today is Michael Kidd. Thanks for listening, all. Be well. Stay safe. I'm Diane Rehm.